SCP-6462, The Implicit Door. The SCP universe has its fair share of godlike entities, many of them quite capable of obliterating reality as we know it. Some of them are actually contained by the Foundation, but many of them are barred from entry for other reasons. The Scarlet King has been a long-standing threat to existence, always perpetually on the fringes of our reality and desperate to come in and wipe everything out. His seven brides and their children are also themselves incredibly powerful and anomalous, with most of them also capable of ending humanity at a moment's notice. SCP-6462 concerns one such bride, locked away for all time, although, of course, she'd rather not be. I'll mention here that I'm not going to go over too much of the Scarlet King mythos in this video, since it's still enjoyable without in-depth knowledge, but I'll recommend my own video on the Scarlet King if you'd like to know more. With that, let's take a look. SCP-6462 is a pocket reality located within Relic Universe 7V Omega, which was previously believed to have been rendered unable to sustain reality during the Third Crimson Crusade, one of the first recorded cross-universe wars. Its position within the Relic Universe appears to have hidden its existence from the multiverse at large, as all available multiverse maps display it as an empty dead zone. The only way to independently learn of the pocket reality's existence is to isolate 6462-A, trace it to its point of origin, and then utilize a Scranton-Meyerbeer arc to travel to that origin point. Needless to say, it's a pretty hard-to-find location. 6462-A is an anomalous form of radiation that occurs in the space between universes. It was developed through the Tri-Frost Initiative, an ongoing Foundation program to develop a non-anomalous method of cross-universe transportation, and its anomalous properties were brought to light by the standard exposure tests that were performed following its discovery. These tests involved exposing subjects to concentrated emissions of this radiation, and then closely monitoring them for physical or psychological changes. The first 45 tests are removed from the log for brevity's sake, but the 46th test, performed on 3 live chickens, revealed something more interesting. Autopsies of the 3 chickens revealed that the stomach linings of 2 of them became lined with teeth-like growths. The third subject's stomach appeared unaltered, but further examination revealed that it was entirely composed of human ovarian tissue. The subject's stomach tissue was discovered to be genetically identical to ovarian tissue samples taken from SCP-231-5. One of the subjects that was rescued from the organization called the Children of the Scarlet King before perishing. In test 57, which was performed on 15D class, the subjects reported regularly experiencing strange and upsetting dreams over the course of the month following their exposure. A majority of reports display imagery and themes commonly found in the religious texts of the Children of the Scarlet King. We're provided a few of the D-class's dream reports, starting with one that reports being in a cave that was also a river, and it being completely dark. They had a rope tied around their waist, which they knew led back to the surface. They were barefoot, and it was quiet, with only the sound of dripping water. Sometimes they heard someone else breathing, hot, on the back of their neck, and it felt like they were getting bitten. Whenever that happened, they'd freak out and start running, but they'd forget about the rope and have to turn back. Eventually, they found the surface, but then they looked down and realized that the rope was actually their own intestines, with the other end tied to a tree at the mouth of the cave. Another had a dream in which they were going to a party with their sisters, but they were all really sad about it. They never got to the party, though, as it was like they were always on the verge of arriving. When asked about the sisters they had in the dream, the D-class says that all 6 or 7 of them were wearing these long gowns and had heavy metal bracelets on both wrists. Another D-class had a dream in which he was in some kind of ceremony or ritual, like something from a bad horror movie. There was chanting, guys in robes, and a young girl in a white gown chained to a stone slab. He expected the girl to look terrified, but she was just sort of resigned. They gave the D-class a dagger to cut her open, but before they could make him do it, he woke up. He then appears conflicted before saying that they wouldn't have needed to make him do it, as he wanted to do it, and still does. He rubs his face with his hands and says that he thinks there's something really wrong with him. He was administered Class C amnestic shortly after the interview's conclusion. Another D-class, when interviewed about their dream, simply stated the word red. When requested to clarify, they attempted to comply but were unable to describe their dream in any other words. Another D-class, during her interview, remarks that she doesn't remember her dad's face. He died in a car crash when she was 9, and she doesn't remember his face. He came into her room last night, through the red of the howling moon's eye, but his face was wrong. He wasn't wearing it right. She then begins bleeding from her left nostril and says that here he comes now, before suffering from a severe heart attack. The pocket reality of SCP-6462 does not experience a day-night cycle, but instead experiences a perpetual dim light from a star similar to our sun. It lacks any form of native, non-bacterial organic life, and muscle mass atrophies at an increased rate within the reality, though not at a pace that cannot be counteracted by exercise and a high-protein diet. With the exception of 6462-B, its landscape is predominantly flat and featureless, dotted with stone outcroppings. 6462-B is a 2,500-square-kilometer city situated within the reality, the structures of which bear strong stylistic similarities to pre-Renaissance Davite architecture, though no physical evidence of human habitation has been found. With one exception, all of the structures are hollow and deceptively fragile, and nearly all instances of text have eroded to the point of illegibility. The city is inhabited, however, by an unknown number of humanoid entities composed of dense, shadowy matter. These entities temporarily cease existing while directly perceived, and so all sightings have been in the periphery of the viewer's vision, or heard in such a way that the listener was uncertain of the sound's source. Any camera within a 52-meter radius of one of these entities may begin displaying one or more entities that are not actually there, and up to 44% of recorded images of the entities are potentially false. These entities are aggressive and violent, but not directly confrontational, usually choosing targets that are alone or attacking through ambushes. They are, however, either unable or unwilling to harm or impede Foundation personnel within one structure in the city, and so its central hall has been made the location of the central base camp within the reality. Before this discovery was made, MTF Aleph 7 attempted to create a safe zone where Foundation researchers could work with relative safety. During this time, one agent, Gabriel Dubois, was separated from his team in an altercation that destroyed his portable radio and damaged the broadcaster on his body cam. 45 minutes later, his body cam continued broadcasting, showing him in what he thinks to be some kind of hospital on the third floor. He's barricaded the door, and it's managed to hold so far, although he has no idea how, as the furniture is very brittle. He only barricaded the door because he thought it would slow them down as he climbed out the window, but there are none in this room. He thinks those shadow entities are waiting just outside the door, as he can hear them whispering. He approaches the door, where indistinct voices can be heard. He thinks that they're telling him to open the door, over and over again, but he's not sure why they don't just do it themselves. He's seen one of them pull a man's arms off like a kid with a Barbie. A clearer voice is then heard saying that he's thinking of the wrong door. Dubois yells and turns, and the broadcast ends, with the final image seen appearing to be a window in a room. His body has not yet been recovered. The singular structure of importance in the city is located approximately at its center, and is a large palace host to multiple spatial anomalies, as moving through a doorway inside the palace transports the subject into a different random room. The seventh doorway one travels through will always return the subject to the central hall. The only thresholds not subject to this anomaly are the doorways at both ends of the central hall, one being the front entrance, and the other leading to the throne room. Currently, 306 distinct rooms have been discovered within the palace, and we're given a brief list of some of the more notable ones. There's the central hall and the throne room, as well as a conservatory containing several forms of dead plant matter, including gold leaves of similar hue and shape to that of an apple tree. Specifically, it's noted that it's similar to the Ithune variety of apple tree, apparently a reference to the Norse goddess Ithune, responsible for cultivating golden apples that provided the Norse gods with immortality. Another room is the armory, with 45% of the objects found inside of it being utilized to construct the on-site Surtr-class warhead. 47% of the room's contents have been transferred to a hazardous materials storage site, and the remaining 8% have not been moved, as attempting to do so has been deemed too dangerous. There's also a library, and although almost all texts in the room have been rendered unsalvageable, four legible texts have been uncovered. The first partially resembles existing descriptions of SCP-6019, a complex religious rite connected to the origins of Sarkicism, the Church of the Broken God, and the Church of the Scarlet King. The other three texts are currently being translated. There's a bloodletting room, and upon entry into this room, all adjacent thresholds automatically seal themselves until the stone bowl in the center is filled with 2 liters of blood. There's also an empty chamber in which the floor is covered with an unknown tar-like substance, and loud knocking can be heard through its northeast wall. This is a reference to SCP-4221, an entity that secretes a black tar-like substance and is terrified of the color red and the number 7. Room 238 is a birthing room, although the cognitohazard in its description has been expunged, and room 253 is the ocean chamber. This room contains a body of water of unknown size that vastly exceeds the surface area of the palace. Cursory explorations of this room have uncovered the fossilized remains of an unknown mammalian species that bears extreme resemblance to a sperm whale. This is a reference to the somewhat jokey, somewhat serious take that the Scarlet King, his brides, and their offspring are all whales. Moving on, 6462-C is a stone casket approximately 3 meters wide, 5 meters long, and 2 meters deep. It's suspended in the air above a stone throne in the center of the throne room, wrapped in 7 chains composed of an unknown silver material. Each chain is attached to a metal loop that has been embedded in either the north or south wall. A fourth loop has been observed on the south wall, but no evidence of an eighth chain has yet been found. The casket has a desiccating effect on all forms of liquid and organic matter within a 5.4 meter to 2.2 kilometer radius, with the rate of desiccation and size of its range of effect being inversely proportional to the amount of liquid removed from the casket within a recent time span. Entrance into the palace was not initially possible until 3 members of the MTF accidentally entered the casket's range of effect, subsequently losing all moisture in their bodies within 2.9 seconds. There is a symbol crudely etched into the casket's lid, partially obscured by its chains. It appears to be a Davite glyph, meaning lack, thirst, hunger, longing, or emptiness. We're provided a link to the tale Dust and Blood, which details a number of aspects about the Scarlet King and his brides. That seal corresponds to the fifth bride, Anut, stated to be strong in mind but frail in body, her children being masters of the hidden arts and destroyers of men and cities. For their great power, the king had them crippled so that they might not rise up against him. Her seal means lacking, for her spirit is restless. Her hunger shall never be satisfied, and her thirst shall never be quenched. Probably best to keep that casket closed then, and in fact, the document states that the casket is not to be interacted with under any circumstances, although this line is crossed out. An email was sent by O511 to the rest of the O5 Council, in which they propose lifting the ban on communication with Anut. They acknowledge the risks involved, as one needs to only look to the list of SCPs confirmed to be children of the Seven Brides to understand the danger she poses. This is a being that creates harbingers of doomsday in droves, and the amount of death that this thing has caused is truly unfathomable. But be that as it may, the information they could gain regarding the Scarlet King from her is invaluable. They're sure that the rest of the Council has seen the latest reports on what he's done to the latest batch of universes to open the way to his armies. This is a unique opportunity to make a step towards ending his reign, so they can't afford to be overly squeamish about their own safety. Even if the worst comes to pass and she breaks her chains, O511 tells them to remember that this world will die in the dark so that all worlds may live in the light. The council puts the proposal to a vote, which very narrowly passes, and so Dr. Anvi Madras is chosen to interview her. Anut attempts to speak multiple times, wheezing and coughing quietly with each attempt, before saying that it has been some time since she last had reason to speak. She asks Madras if she is a scholar, to which Madras says, of a sort, as she's a researcher. Anut is glad to speak with one of like mind, and she will answer her questions to the best of her knowledge. She does warn her, though, that her mind has grown sluggish with its lack of proper use, and it will take some time before the webbing has cleared from her thoughts. Madras starts by asking her if she knows where she is right now. Anut replies that she believes she was entombed in the throne room of her firstborn son. A little joke by her husband, she thinks. Her firstborn was always so abominably loyal, despite her greatest efforts, and he probably got himself killed in her name when she was sealed away. Madras asks who her husband is, to which Anut just asks why she asks questions she already knows the answer to. She tells Madras not to ask her of Karak just yet, as just thinking of him makes her scars ache. Madras moves on to asking about this place, and Anut explains that this was the first nursery world she ever built. She has many children, and they needed a place to learn and grow. She apologizes if they've given them any trouble on their way in, as their will is not their own. Madras asks if she means the shadows, and Anut replies that when she first guided them along the hidden paths of her magic, her husband grew paranoid. He broke their bodies upon the rocks of the shore, and when that was done, to ensure that they would never heal correctly, he stole their shadows. It's fitting that he would choose shadows to be her jailers, as this entire world has become a pale reflection of itself. She wonders what it looks like now, as it was still so alive when he sealed her away. Madras asks how she knows it's dead if it was alive when she was sealed away, and she says that her cage may have left her sightless, but not entirely without sense. When this place was alive, the wind would skim along the curves and ridges of the spawning fields and make such beautiful music, as though the sky was singing. Now there is only the silence of a mausoleum, of a world scoured. There is naught but dust, and not even blood remains. She then says that she has grown weary, as speech after an age of silence is more tiresome than she expected. Madras interviews her again on another day, and Anut now says that she believes she is prepared to speak more about her husband, the Scarlet King. Madras asks her if she can describe his true nature, causing Anut to pause for an extended period of time. She eventually says that Karak is fundamentally a frightened, angry child. He was born into a world that brings him unending pain, and so he lashes out. Rather than adapt to his surroundings or change them to his liking, he seeks to tear it all down. Like a child, he is blind to the contradiction of his desires, as he wishes to destroy all things to experience the peace of non-being, but is terrified of death. He is immortal in every way, as he taught himself the syllables of royalty, partaken from fountains and orchards of eternal life, erased his name from the tablets of death, and melted down the wings of archangels into gold nails and pounded them into his flesh. Anut says that he's just delaying the inevitable, though, as everything ends. She likens his schemes to that of a child's favorite doll, clutched close in the belief that it will keep the nightmares away. Madras remarks that that is illuminating, but it's not what she meant. She wants to know more about what the Scarlet King is, not who, but Anut just asks her what she thinks the Shormaush Urdal is. Madras thinks that she's avoiding the question, but replies that the leading theory is that the Scarlet King is the embodiment of the struggle between the modern and pre-modern, the howl of the old straining against the new. Anut assumes that this theory speaks of the Foundation's role in this, their gray modernity choking the world until it bleeds scarlet. She thinks that it's a rather self-centered way of seeing things, as the Shormaush Urdal is a fire that sweeps across every reality and every world. He does not limit his gaze to their species alone, so why would they claim sole credit for his apotheosis? Madras asks if they're wrong then, but Anut says that their theory is entirely on the mark, but they have it inside out. They consider this war of the ancient and contemporary to be a grand flame that casts the shadow that is Karak onto the walls of the cave. But are they certain that it is not Karak that is the fire, and the war that is the shadow? Madras asks if she means to say that the concepts of modernity and pre-modernity are extensions of the Scarlet King, but Anut just says that she merely offers it as a thought exercise. She then ends the interview, stating that her scars ache once more, and she needs her rest. Another interview occurs sometime later, and Madras asks Anut to list the methods that the Scarlet King has used to obtain his immortality. Anut replies that, as she said before, his immortality is a fool's errand, a delaying tactic. To make oneself truly deathless is an impossible task. Madras insists, however, and it reminds Anut of a story her mother once told her, a tale of a girl who attempted a likewise impossible task. I'll include the story here verbatim. Once, a very long time ago, there was a girl made of glass who lived in a little house by the river. The girl was a fragile thing. A hard wind could cut her skin, a simple flick could shatter bone, a harsh word could leave bruises that ached for weeks. Often bedridden by injury or illness, the girl found herself with all the time in the world to read, and read she did. The girl read anything she could get her hands on. No matter the subject, she would descend upon the pages like a wolf on a sun-baked carcass, ravenously devouring every morsel of knowledge until there was naught but bones. She was insatiable. She read and read and read, and when she had finished reading, she went back and read some more. Soon the girl had mastered nearly every subject, every field of study. She could calculate the mathematics of the stars in her head. She mapped the hidden paths of magic on the insides of dust covers. She knew the name of every animal and all the secret words of creation. Yet, for all her learning, one thing continued to lay beyond her reach: the great ash tree on the other side of the river. She knew only two things of the tree. Firstly, it was a thing of some renown. Rumor said that its roots stretched far beyond its gated garden to every continent and kingdom, from the fragrant shores of the city of hedonist dreams to the circuitous trails of the name-eater's grove to even the blank vistas of the angled colonies. People would travel for miles just to sit beneath its wide branches. The second thing she knew was that her father hated the tree with a passion. It represented everything that he was not, everything that he stood against, and he despised the tree for that. In the rare moments that he slept, he dreamed only of fire engulfing the tree, of tearing each root from the earth until only its memory remained. Each morning, the girl's father set out to make his dream a reality, and each morning, he failed. The currents of the river were too strong, threatening to topple the most sturdy of boats. Beyond the river was a set of iron gates that were veined with thorns and poison ivy to prevent trespassers from scaling them. Beyond the gates was a beautiful garden that dazzled and befuddled the mind with its beauty, which was tended to by dozens of devoted gardeners and caregivers, each being willing to give their lives in defense of their home. The girl's father was a man of incredible strength and skill, but not even he could pass these trials. One day, when her father was tending to other business and her sisters were playing in the field beyond her home, the girl set to traveling to the ash tree herself. Blinded by the overconfidence of youth, she believed that these impossible hurdles could be surpassed with the correct application of knowledge. Surely her comprehension of boat building and seafaring was enough to ford the river. Surely her familiarity with plant life was enough to circumvent the thorns and ivy of the gate. Surely she was intelligent enough to not be dazzled by the garden, and articulate enough to convince its guardians to allow her passage. Surely. Ignorant in her genius, the girl left her home to cross the river in a raft of her own design. And that is when something truly miraculous happened. Her plan worked. The river's currents, being strangely tranquil that day, allowed her to cross in peace. When she reached the gates, they opened at her first touch. The garden was surprisingly easy to navigate. Its caretakers nodded at her cheerfully as she passed, making no move to impede her. In a matter of moments, the girl accomplished what her father had sought for years. She had reached the great ash tree. The ash tree was far more beautiful than her books had promised. Sunlight streamed through its vivid leaves, diffusing warmth into its shadows. Innumerable baubles hung from the tree's limbs, clinking merrily in the quiet breeze. The air was smooth and sweet. A garden snake crawled out from its home in the roots of the ash tree. Looking up at her, it began to speak. "Welcome to my tree," said the snake. "This tree is yours?" queried the girl, confused. "How can a snake own a tree?" "I was here first," hissed the snake. "I knew this tree before the first men walked on two legs." "That doesn't make sense," retorted the girl, who cared a great deal about what did and did not square with her perception of reality. "There's no reptile in the world that could live that long, not even the most resilient of tortoises." "It doesn't make sense, does it?" agreed the snake. "You must be a clever one." "I'm the cleverest," preened the girl, puffing out her chest. "All my sisters say so." "You must be, to have made it all the way here," said the snake. "Not many do. Not many even think to look for a way. Few understand that the first step of the journey will take you most of the way there. Would you like to live in my tree, child? The girl could only laugh, so taken aback was she by the audacity of the snake's offer. Foolish snake, she chided. What could a tree full of insects and rodents and who knows what else have to offer me? Knowledge, said the snake. The insects and rodents in my tree are a part of this world, not mere observers. She has taught them all her secrets. They could do the same for you, who share their unending hunger. Here you could spend your days doing whatever you loved most. Here you could be loved without reservation or condition. Here, if you wish it, you will never be touched by a man ever again. A profound ache opened in the girl's chest. Being accustomed to sudden, unexplained pain, she ignored it. Idiot snake, snapped the girl. I belong to my house. I belong to my father. I have no choice in this matter. I came here to help him burn this place to the ground. Oh, child, whispered the snake. There is always a choice. The ache in her doubled in size, then redoubled. It was an emotion she didn't know how to describe. She could not see the shape of it. She did not know the name of the animal in her chest. She shook her head, words abandoning her. To choose between an uncertain happiness and a certain agony was not a choice at all. So accustomed was she to this life that she hated, that joy seemed to be an even greater terror. She could not even visualize it. The girl turned on her heel and fled. She ran away from the great ash tree, through the garden, past the gates, and onto her raft. It wasn't until she had reached the other shore that she ever looked back. Madras asks if that story is true, and Anut replies that of course it is, asking if her mother never told her that all stories are true. In another interview, Anut says that she begins to grow weary of discussing her husband, and Madras actually asks her about her sisters. Anut is silent for 2 minutes, before explaining that there was always supposed to be 7 of them. 7 is a number of power, after all, a portentous symbol, and even in those days when the world was still young, this was known to many. Personally, she prefers to use the rule of 3s in her spellcraft, as it's more flexible, though that's not to say that she's chosen the path of the 3-in-1. The mother maiden crone is nothing but a shortcut, an illusion of power. Magic in 5s has also been an option for her, being the 5th daughter, the 5th bride, but she's never been the religious sort, alluding to 5thism. Madras asks if her and her sisters were born to fulfill a particular goal, and Anut says that they were. Karak is the great destroyer, the beast waiting at the gates, the inevitable end of all things. He can only destroy and take. He cannot create. So that is why he needed Sana, her mother, and his 7 brides. Madras asks if he doesn't need them anymore. And Anut pauses before replying that, for the longest time, she looked down on her youngest sister. She was always the weakest of them all, soft-hearted and weak-willed, but now she thinks that she did surpass them in one respect. She had the most courage. Madras asks what she means, and Anut says that she was the only one who ever tried to leave. In the next interview, Madras asks how the Scarlet King spreads his influence to different universes, to which Anut says that there are 2 answers to that question. The first is that the Scarlet King's greatest weapon is his very being. He is like water, spreading to fill any open space, pouring himself into containers to take their shape. He flows into the hollow spaces of false histories to make them his, referencing SCP-140 and SCP-6140 with the false history of the Daevites. He draws the wills of the like-minded into the tides of his thoughts, pushes them to open doorways, pulls them to spread word of his coming through art and song. He does not create, he takes, he subsumes. He is an unyielding torrent that no dam can contain. For the second answer, she provides another story. Once, there was a brass princess who lived in a great and terrible kingdom by the sea. The brass princess was not a thing of flesh, but of metal. You see, the king of this terrible kingdom was full of rage and hate, forever warring against all of creation. No woman was willing to marry him, not even when threatened with torture or death. Thus, he ordered the greatest engineer in all the land to build him 7 wives that would stand by his side eternally. The first bride was made of gold. The second bride was made of silver. The third bride was made of bronze. The fourth bride was made of iron. The fifth bride was made of brass. The sixth bride was made of steel. And the seventh, smallest bride was cobbled together with the scraps of metal left behind by the first 6 brides. One day, on the anniversary of the king's birth, he was visited by a man who did not have a name. The man was pale, tall, and thin. He was knowledgeable in the esoteric arts and was subject to no law but his own. All things that could harbor fear in their hearts held it for him alone. The king was no different. Their meeting was short-lived, a simple exchange of threats and glares across marble halls, nothing more. Nothing more was necessary for the pale man's purposes. It was not the first time the nameless man had made such a social call, nor would it be the last, but this time was different. After their encounter had run its course, the king found that fear still lurked in his heart. A paranoia that froze his gut and boiled his mind. Seeing the storm brewing beneath his brow, the gold bride, who had earned the title of queen through masterful performances of loyalty, came to him, her face a perfect mask of concern. "What troubles you, husband of mine?" asked the queen. "What could bring such discontent on this celebration of your birth?" "I am concerned," said the king, who was too proud to admit fear of anything. "There are dangers abroad in the world, things that, despite my greatest efforts, could bring me harm." "Surely not," exclaimed the queen. "You are wise and powerful beyond compare, are you not? Are not you the master of every land across this world, free to destroy whatever you wish?" "This is true," begrudged the king. "And you have your wives, my king. In whatever danger you may come to face, you shall not do it alone. Are we not the greatest weapons in your arsenal, your brides of metal?" "Yes," he said. He had suddenly become very still. "You are." The queen had not trained in the art of prophecy. She wasn't an oracle. She did not search for omens in gleaming intestines or clattering bones. In fact, she detested the idea that the path of her future could be directed by any hand that was not her own. But in that moment, looking into her husband's burning eyes, she saw a vision of her own death. Later that night, in secret, the queen called the other brides to her quarters to speak of what she saw. "I fear the worst," said the queen, her delicate hands clasped together. "I believe he has grown affrighted of our strength, believing that we may one day turn that strength against him. He would sooner end us than risk his own ending." "You truly are a coward," sneered the bronze bride. Should we really be panicking over a simple vision? We should, whispered the Steel Bride from behind a chair in the corner of the room. I saw him as I traveled here in shadow. He stands in his great forge, where he has begun taking up his armaments of war. As we speak, he dons the russet armor he wore when he killed our creator mother. For a moment, the other brides were stunned into silence, half due to the Steel Bride's news, half because she had spoken at all. Then we kill him, yes? Spoke up the Iron Bride, brash as ever. We take up our own weapons and armor, and we kill him so hard that our people will not be able to conceive how dead he is. No, said the Silver Bride. That would perhaps have been possible in the past, were we all working in concert, but not now, not when he has enshrined himself in fear and violence. He makes himself into a storm. He makes himself untouchable. Our only recourse is to flee. That is no recourse, said the Queen. He would set our people upon us and hunt us to the furthest star if he needed to. Listen close, sisters, said the Brass Bride, a clever glint in her eyes. I have a plan. This should be good, snorted the Bronze Bride. Hush, said the Queen. Our sister is wise in the ways of magic and many other things besides. We should hear her out. To survive, there is only one thing we can do, said the Brass Bride. We must convince him to spare our lives. You see, I have a proposal for him. Instead of slaying us, he will instead seal each of us away in a prison of his own design. In sealing his seven brides away, he shall seal himself away as well. This is the way of things. You've gone rusted, haven't you? Cried the Silver Bride, beside herself with fear. There's a dent in your head, isn't there? Your gears must be crooked. Why would he ever agree to that? The answer is simple, said the Brass Bride. In sealing himself away, he creates a lock that separates him from all worlds. The presence of a lock implies the presence of a door that it keeps shut, implies a key that may open it. Magic, you see, is a thing of symbols and implication. Something implied or symbolized is something that can be made real. He creates a lock, a set of chains, a closed door that shuts him off from all worlds. And the thing about doors is that they open both ways. A door that cuts off all worlds is a door that may open to any world. All he needs is someone to make a key, to use symbols of the seven sealed brides to open the way. Surely you jest, growled the scrap metal bride, who had not spoken since the meeting began. Surely this is a corroded joke at our expense. Surely you would not aid our husband in his war against creation just to prolong our lives. Surely you would not be so monstrous. Monstrous, perhaps, replied the Brass Bride, but also necessary. His paranoia was not entirely unfounded. We are, perhaps, one of the only things in the world that may one day kill him. To preserve all things, we must first preserve ourselves. As the rest of her sisters murmured their agreement, the scrap metal bride could only blink back angry, oily tears. Do what you will, she muttered. Just know that I can see through your lies, sister, even if you cannot. The king sent each of his brides to a prison of his own design. The gold bride was trapped in a birdcage and brought to one of the king's greatest allies as a gift. The silver bride was cast into a shattered ocean. The bronze bride was sold to the denizens of the deepest hell. The iron bride was entombed in the heart of a hateful star, which fed on her pain to only grow brighter. The steel bride was sent to a place that had no name. The scrap metal bride, who had never been loyal to the king, was imprisoned in the king's palace, where he could keep an eye on her personally. Finally, the brass bride was brought to a hidden junkyard, where knowledge held no meaning, made hollow by the wind. The king knew that his wife was clever, knew that her finely tuned mind could unravel any trap he placed her in, rebuild any piece of her he broke. So it was her mind that he chose to break. He reached into her head and ground her clockwork thoughts into a fine powder. With this final act of cruelty, the princess was brought low and dispersed, as a mist, into the dark. Madras asks why she answers some questions directly and others with lengthy stories. Anut replies that perhaps it's because the walls of narratives arrange answers you could never understand into recognizable patterns. Perhaps her bindings prevent her from speaking of certain topics, which she circumvents through symbol and circumlocution. Perhaps she has grown whimsical in her old age and isolation. Perhaps she enjoys listening to her twist in the wind as she grasps for understanding. Or perhaps storytelling is the only thing left to her, sealed in this forsaken place. Madras then asks if this was a story also given to her by her mother, but Anut says that she never knew her mother, as she died before Anut was born. Later, Madras tells Anut that everything that's been happening with her doesn't add up. Anut plays dumb, but Madras says that she's not the first contained deity she's dealt with. At no point has she ever tried to convince Madras to let her out, with no threats, no promises of God wishes, not even a simple request of freedom. Anut asks if she would prefer that she threaten her, but Madras would just prefer that she stop acting suspicious as hell. Anut is surprised that her fellow scholars would permit her to speak to her interview subject like this, but Madras says that she's in charge, and how she speaks is her own prerogative. Anut has made this so easy, giving information with barely any resistance, and her stories are clearly about herself. There's only one reason she would have for any of this, and that's because she's planning something. Anut replies that Madras has been most entertaining, and as a token of her appreciation, she proposes a game of sorts. She will tell her one final tale, and if Madras can divine the true meaning buried in the prose, then she shall make her intentions bare to her. If not, there will be no more interviews with anyone, and she will lie here in silence until the end of time and beyond. Madras asks how can she trust her to tell the truth if she wins, but Anut says that she knows what kind of creature Anut is, and she does not consider the breaking of oaths lightly. Madras concedes, and Anut tells one more story. Once, there was a haze of disconnected thoughts that floated in an unceasing abyss. The haze was not a girl, or a princess, or a person. It was not made of glass, or brass, or flesh. It was a vapid, drifting thing. It could not understand what a person was, could not comprehend what it was to be an I or a you. It understood nothing, feeling everything. The haze had neither past nor future, forever suspended in an agonizing now. Adrift in the sweltering void, it shuddered with fevered nightmares. It wept. It watched with idle, vacant eyes as its fault lines groaned and ground against one another, spreading spider webs of stress fractures. The thing was a tectonic shift, a ceaseless churn, a flooded temple. Kingdoms rose and fell, oceans overflowed, then exsanguinated in the dirt. Stars were born in exhalations of light, matured and auto-cannibalized, and still it slept on. The world flowed and cracked, the yolk dripping through the ruins of its mind, past the teeth of its heart. The sky was engulfed in hungry flame. The gardens suffocated and the rivers bloomed with tumors. It was all ending. Everything was ending, always ending. An unceasing chain of doomsday. The prophecies were all true. The soothsayer's entrails were warm and slick in its red-stained palms. And its sister said, "There is no such thing as an ending." And its father said, "Don't cry, sweet thing. Don't cry. I'll give you a reason to fucking cry." And its mother said, "I'm sorry." And its mother said, "Just hold on. Hold on." And its mother said, "Come home." And a dream came, and the dream was made of vellum. And in the dream it saw the girl, and the garden snake, and the sunlight streaming through the leaves of the great ash tree. "There is always a choice," said the world. And the woman remembered who she was. Madras ponders the story for a moment, wondering to herself why Anut chose stories specifically. Anut says that she thinks narratives are quite interesting, as they're the only tools she has left. In a way, they are much like magic, following the laws of emotion and symbol. They do what feels right, not what is right. And like a spell, a story can take so many shapes. A comedy, a tragedy, a romance, a mystery, a misdirection. A story can be nearly anything. It could be a tantalizing thread of questions spoken into the spectrum of radiation, buried so deep in the firmament that one's father would never see it, but someone truly dedicated to scouring the world of its secrets could. A story could take the shape of a winding chain, or a key in three parts, or an open door. To tell a story is akin to speaking an incantation. With the right words, you can bring someone to a different world, or take someone out of it. Madras realizes what Anut has done at this point, and immediately radios Site Command to detonate the warhead now. Anut continues, saying that if one's audience is listening intently, recording and analyzing every word, every turn of phrase, then there's no end to what you could do. Madras orders Site Command again to detonate, calling it a code Nightmare Regent Red, and stating that 6462 is about to breach containment. Anut, however, says that she is mistaken, as they left nearly a minute ago. The document then switches to a different article, one composed entirely of prose. Madras was sitting in a plush chair in what appeared to be a large reading room, with bookshelves towering like skyscrapers around her. All was quiet, save for the hushed voices of library patrons in distant stacks. It wasn't that she had been suddenly teleported to this strange place. There was no jolt of surprise when she became aware of these surroundings, but rather like a dream, as one moment she was there and then the next moment she had always been here. The transition from one state to the other was hard to grasp. Across from her was another plush chair, in which a hooded figure sat. They were garbed in a red robe that shrouded most of their body, but she could see a pair of insectoid limbs sticking out from their sleeves, and an equally chitinous head, half covered by their hood. The figure in the robe gazed back at her with two sets of eyes, each sparkling with ancient intelligence and private humor. They shook slightly, in a way that reminded Madras of her grandmother. It was as though simply sitting upright was a significant exertion for them. Anut then winked, and Madras suddenly felt very distant from herself, submerged in a sort of icy, calm fear. She was completely at Anut's mercy, as killing her would require less than a thought. She began vividly imagining Anut's claws materializing inside her chest to caress her heart with horrible tenderness. It would take only the slightest squeeze to pop it like a balloon. Madras says that she only noticed just now, but she probably already knew that. Anut nods and says that she did, causing another chill to run down Madras. She then mentions the bomb, and Anut tilts her head slightly, asking if she means this bomb. A second set of arms emerged from inside her robes, more human than the first. Sitting in her left palm was a small sphere of glass wound in wires and bits of metal. The sphere was full of a murky yellow liquid, with something indistinct floating inside. Madras's clearance hadn't been high enough for her to know what. Anut held it up to the light, arm trembling slightly, and says that she's rather impressed with her people. It would be difficult for even an individual of her talents to obtain such a fascinating toy. Madras remarks that that's Foundation property, but she winces after saying it, and Anut barks out a laugh, seemingly surprised by her audacity. She says that she has a suspicion that her Foundation considers Anut to be much the same, so it's only fitting that she holds on to it. Her hand closes around it, then opens to reveal empty air. For a moment, there was silence between the two, and not far behind Anut, Madras could see what appeared to be a sapient colony of mice discussing the pros and cons of Maya Angelou's prose style with an energy vortex in a turtleneck sweater. She suspects that she's in the Wanderer's Library, and she dreamed of coming here ever since she had first read its file. But this felt more like a nightmare. She finally says to Anut that they played right into her hands, and they were doomed the moment they decided to interview her. Anut tilts her head and contemplates this for a moment, before stating that she shall give her a parting gift as a reward for her assistance. Madras said nothing, as she'd been working at the Foundation long enough to know better than to turn down a divine reward, since gods often took that as a grave insult. Anut says that this is some information that her Foundation will likely find quite interesting, should Madras find her way back to them. Her sisters have many flaws, but it should never be said that they are not resourceful. If she has escaped her bonds, it is likely that they have recently done the same, or will be doing so in the days to come. Chitinous plates fold up in what appeared to be a sort of humorless smile, as she says that very few of them are as courteous as she is. She then clicks her claws on the edge of her chair, and space begins to fold around it, pressing itself into fractals that shift and shrink. She says that now she must be going, as she's left a friend of hers waiting for long enough. Madras watches as space continues to fold around the chair, like a set of jaws waiting to close, before speaking on some stupid, half-baked impulse. She asks what happens to the girl in her story, and where does she go in the end? The fractals pause for a fraction of a moment, pulling the contorted space taut before returning to their folding. Something flickered across Anut's face, not an emotion exactly, but its shadow. The imprint of a body in dark waters. Anut states that she goes home. The girl finally goes home. Then the sky bit down, and Anut was gone. Alright, so I don't think there's a great mystery here that needs to be unraveled, as what happened is fairly clear. The Foundation came across one of the Scarlet King's seven brides, locked away very deeply in a pocket dimension that's practically impossible to find. Rather than just letting her sit there until the end of time, one O5 council member has the bright idea to have someone start chatting with her, hoping to get some information that the Foundation can use against the Scarlet King, who is very much a looming threat to existence. Of course, Anut doesn't want to sit there as a captive until the end of time, but rather than doing the usual deific things of threatening captors or promising power, she proceeds to be rather amicable, sharing a few stories with her interviewer. In what proves to be a particularly blockheaded moment that neither Madras nor anyone else on the research team seem to notice, Madras allows Anut to share one more story, making it a nice, even 3. Despite Anut providing ample warning about the power of narratives, symbolism, and her particular talent for magic associated with the number 3, no one stops her from telling the third story, allowing her to easily break containment. The Scarlet King mythos is among the more esoteric elements of the SCP universe, but needless to say, the king is a pretty big threat, and so are most of his brides. Although they aren't exactly fond of the Scarlet King themselves, having been sealed away forever just to prevent the possibility of them overthrowing him, they are by no means allies to the Foundation. It does sometimes seem like there are more articles depicting the Foundation as being a bit blundering rather than being hyper-competent, but it's tough to compete with ancient deities, I guess.